If you're enjoying History Extra Long Reads, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thank you for your support. I hope you enjoy this episode.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow, now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
Another day is here and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored? Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
Hello and welcome to History Extra Long Reads, where we take a deep dive into the past, bringing you the very best of BBC History Magazine, with fascinating articles from leading historical experts. From the heroic glamour of Henry V to the heady nationalism of Braveheart, the medieval era has proven a rich source of material for film directors. In this long read, historian Robert Bartlett charts Hollywood's long obsession with the Middle Ages. Today's feature originally appeared in the March 2024 issue of BBC History Magazine and has been voiced in partnership with the Royal National Institute of Blind People.
The 1890s turned out to be a significant decade for William Wallace, Richard the Lionheart, and Joan of Arc. That's because it witnessed the birth of an art form, one that would present their extraordinary stories to a global audience, the moving picture. The pioneers of this new medium went quickly from single-shot novelty pieces to short narratives to films an hour or more in length. Meanwhile, thousands of custom-built venues popped up across America, Europe, and beyond. In the dying days of the 19th century, a new industry was born. That industry was greedy for stories, and by the dawn of the 20th century, it was mining many of these tales from the distant past. There has never been a genre of medieval film in the way that there has been of westerns or sword and sandal epics like Ben-Hur or Gladiator. But the past 130 years have witnessed a deluge of movies inspired by the Middle Ages. These have been based on real persons or events, such as El Cid or Joan of Arc. Inspired by medieval legends, King Arthur and Robin Hood, or if we stretch our definition, have been set in imaginary worlds with medieval features like The Lord of the Rings. What kind of Middle Ages do these films present to us? The technology of moving pictures may have been new in the 1890s, but cinema was marked by the culture into which it was born, late Romantic European nationalism. This is clear both from the music of early cinema, silent films were never silent, and from the acting styles of those early films, which borrowed from theatre and opera and often strike modern audiences as melodramatic. It is also evident from the filmmakers' assumptions about heroism, nationalism, and romantic love. These characteristics are clear to see in the Nibelungs, Die Nibelungen, which was released in 1924. Based on medieval German and Scandinavian stories, Fritz Lang's two-part epic tells the story of the tall, blonde dragon slayer Siegfried, his love for the beautiful Kriemhilde, his tragic death, and Kriemhild's revenge. It has a specially composed score. The English premiere took place in the Royal Albert Hall, with the music performed by the London Symphony Orchestra. The actors, most of them experienced stage performers, employ the exaggerated gestures so alien to modern performance. The film's heroic and Germanic tone, and also perhaps the possibly anti-Semitic characterization of the villainous dwarf King Alberich, made it a favorite with the Nazi hierarchy. Lang, the director, who was partly of Jewish descent, wisely moved to Hollywood in 1934. Many medieval films are marked by a vocal and emphatic nationalism. In El Cid, 1961, the eponymous hero is fighting for Spain, a country that did not exist in the 11th century, while the nationalism in Braveheart, 1995, was so heady that it was even credited with swinging voters towards the Scottish National Party. The nationalism in these films is defensive, responding to an external threat, which is usually easier to romanticize than wars of conquest. Laurence Olivier's Henry V is an exception to this rule, perhaps because it was made in 1944, when an invasion of France could be seen as heroic. Sergei Eisenstein's Alexander Nevsky, 1938, is a classic example of such defensive nationalist epics, as the stern figure of Prince Alexander mobilizes the Russian people against the sinister and brutal Germans who are threatening their land. The prince's struggle culminates in the Battle on the Ice, which takes up an amazing 30 minutes of the film, all to a rousing score by Sergei Prokofiev. Alexander Nevsky also provides a classic illustration of how cinema history is shaped by politics. The film was made at a moment when the Soviet Union was anxiously aware of the growing threat from Nazi Germany. Its message of victorious patriotic resistance against encroaching Germans answered the propaganda needs of the time and helped earn Eisenstein the Order of Lenin. But this was a period of huge instability, and in August 1939, Germany and the Soviet Union signed a pact that guaranteed peace between their countries and specified which parts of Poland their nations should swallow up. In the wake of this geopolitical bombshell, Alexander Nevsky was withdrawn from circulation, and Eisenstein was reassigned to work on a Wagner opera. Less than 2 years later, however, in June 1941, Stalin was taken by surprise when Germany launched its gigantic invasion of the Soviet Union. Eisenstein's epic was now re-released, and it was not long before an Order of Alexander Nevsky was instituted for heroism on the front. Very few moments in film history show such a definitive correspondence between political events and a film's fortunes. Another heavyweight medieval topic that has been shaped by modern politics and never really found a happy treatment in film is the Crusades. In the Middle Ages, these enormous military operations could be given a clear narrative, since most Western Christians believed that God wills it, as the cry went up when the First Crusade was launched. Knowing that Palestine had been Christian before it became Muslim, medieval chroniclers could depict the Crusades as self-defense, as recovery of Christ's patrimony, and even, in the words of a Crusader song, as a tournament between heaven and hell. Filmmakers of the 20th and early 21st centuries have chosen not to tread this simple path, since militant Christianity did not appeal to many filmmakers and might well be seen as a dubious prospect in attracting viewers. In a remarkable number of medieval films, the Crusades function simply as a plot device, removing characters from the scene, presenting their lady loves with doubts about whether they are alive or dead, and creating the possibility of a longed-for return.
Hola.
Hello, this call is being translated.
Abuela, listen to what my phone can do.
Abuela, escucha lo que mi teléfono puede hacer.
Wow, ahora dime sobre tu novia nueva.
Wow. Now tell me about this new girlfriend.
Huh?
Tú sabes lo que dije.
You know what I said.
Language is no longer a barrier, thanks to Live Translate with Galaxy AI on Samsung Galaxy S24 Ultra. Learn more at Samsung.com. Samsung account login required. Calls must be made using the native Samsung dialer.
This episode is brought to you by Twizzlers. Long day, late night, feeling a little bored. Twizzlers is the ultimate sidekick for any moment of the day, no matter what kind of day you're having. The perfect level of sweet and a fun excuse to sit back and relax. Unwind with Twizzlers. To buy now, visit Hersheyland.com/Twizzlers.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Sound the gifting panic alarm. You need to get an amazing gift. Wait, no, the perfect gift. Relax. Now you can use Gift Mode on Etsy. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting, so you can find the perfect item for anyone and any occasion. It's easy. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about who you're shopping for and what they like. And Gift Mode instantly gives you curated gift ideas based on hundreds of personas. Now it's simple to find gifts made by independent sellers for all the people in your life. So whether you need a housewarming gift for the new homeowner or a birthday present for the pickleballer, Gift Mode has you covered. Need to find the perfect gift? Don't panic. Try Gift Mode on Etsy now.
Almost every Robin Hood film has King Richard returning from Crusade, but few films have him actually on Crusade. Those films that are set in the Holy Land tend to take their lead from Walter Scott, who established the historical novel as a major genre in the early 19th century. Scott's portrayal of the Crusades in his 1825 novel, The Talisman, centered on the relationship between Richard the Lionheart and Saladin, two rulers of different faiths who engaged in warfare against each other, but who are linked by common chivalric values. Over the course of the 20th century, as the Muslim world was decolonized, as militant Islam grew in strength, and as Muslims migrated to the West in greater numbers, filmmakers realized that portrayals of the Crusades were going to be yet more difficult and harder to depict with a clear perspective. Perhaps this explains the narrative fog that surrounds Ridley Scott's Kingdom of Heaven, 2005. Here, it's not clear who the bad guys are meant to be, what makes the good guys good, or even what's going on. It's clear that Christian extremists are bad and that Saladin is wise and shrewd, as is traditional. This is not to mention the remarkable scene where the main character, played by Orlando Bloom, freshly arrived from France, teaches the local inhabitants of Palestine how to dig a well. Many films with medieval settings are based on literature rather than history, and these usually have a much bigger role for women, since the literature of the period often involves love triangles or love dilemmas. Tales of Arthur, Guinevere and Lancelot, or Tristan, Isolde and Mark, thus have more in common with the modern bourgeois novel, which is often centered on adultery, than stories of the Crusades or national struggles. And from the point of view of Hollywood, it is an advantage that these stories of knightly valour and romantic love are not tied to any modern nation and do not skirt dangerously near to issues of Western colonialism. King Arthur films have traditionally been straightforward adventures, with lots of fighting, love interests, frustrated but then fulfilled, and plenty of manliness and womanliness. Only in the second half of the 20th century do we see the emergence of ironic, unconventional or critical versions of these tales, such as Robert Bresson's Lancelot du Lac, 1974, or John Boorman's Excalibur, 1981. The one film subject absolutely dominated by a woman is the story of Joan of Arc. Starting in the late 1890s, there have been countless films about Joan. This is partly because her story is truly remarkable. A peasant girl who inspired the resistance to the English invaders of France and who led her dauphin to be crowned in Reims before her capture, trial and on the 30th of May 1431, death by fire at the stake. It is also partly because her trial records form one of the richest bodies of reported dialogue to have survived from the Middle Ages, including page after page of Joan's own words. Entire films have been made based exclusively on these documents. Not everyone is dazzled by Joan's charisma. In the final volume of his majestic History of the Hundred Years' War, Jonathan Sumption plays down her role in the relief of Orléans, the turning point of the war, and writes that, subsequently, she inhabited a fantasy world of her own. Yet filmmakers have had little time for such concerns, presenting a character who is inspired and inspiring, who is credibly a teenage girl but can also lead armies. One of the most memorable cinematic interpretations of Joan is Carl Theodor Dreyer's 1928 film The Passion of Joan of Arc. In many ways, it is an austere film. Silent and black and white, of course, it concentrates entirely on Joan's trial and execution, is set in stark interiors, and draws its dialogue from the trial records. Above all, it focuses to an astonishing degree on the faces of the protagonists, the ecclesiastical judges and Joan, played in what seems to have been her only film role by Renée or Marie Falconetti. The heroine's face often fills the entire screen, conveying in vivid detail her sense of mission, her doubts, and her fears. In a sense, there is nothing medieval about Dreyer's film. Its greatness, for those who consider it great, lies in the brilliance of the framing, the pacing, and the acting. But on the other hand, its emphasis on intense, visionary spirituality, on the power of established religion, not at all the same thing, and on the physical brutality of life, does correspond to important features of the medieval world. In these respects, The Passion of Joan of Arc can be compared with two other arthouse classics with medieval subjects, Ingmar Bergman's Seventh Seal, 1957, and Andrei Tarkovsky's Andrei Rublev, 1966. Bergman's film features a real medieval setting, Sweden during the Black Death, but is populated with entirely fictional characters. Tarkovsky's movie is based on a real person, the Russian icon painter Andrei Rublev, surrounded by a mixture of real and imagined events. Both films feature central characters who are troubled by religious doubt, men who are making their way through a landscape where they encounter religious fundamentalism and the brutality of power. A question that is asked of most historical films is, how accurate is it? Medieval historians are sometimes irritated by blatant absurdities, such as the French knights at Agincourt being hoisted onto their horses by cranes, as depicted in Olivier's Henry V, or by the Battle of Stirling Bridge in Braveheart, taking place without a bridge. However, given that medieval historians form but a tiny proportion of cinema audiences, another possible response to this question of accuracy is, does it matter? I would argue that in one important respect it does matter, because divergences from factual accuracy can shine a light on the filmmaker's approach to his or her subject. A perfect example is the romance in Braveheart between the Scottish national hero William Wallace, who was executed in 1305, and the French princess Isabella, who was aged 9 at the time of his execution. This impossible affair was not a result of simple ignorance on the part of the filmmakers, but fits into a larger theme of the film, that the struggle between the English and the Scots extended to a conflict over women's bodies. The trouble starts when the demonic English king Edward I allows English lords in Scotland to sleep with brides on their wedding night. In the first resistance raid, a husband whose wife has endured this kills the lord who was responsible. And Wallace is himself stirred to action after English soldiers attempt to rape his wife. This portrayal of the struggle in sexual terms extends to the main political players. Prince Edward, son of Edward I, cannot satisfy his wife. His notoriously homophobic characterization drew widespread protest, but William Wallace can, and impregnates her, thus diverting the bloodline of the English monarchy. This is totally absurd, but it's not a meaningless absurdity. It has a point to make in the world of the film. As Braveheart proves, people should not go to medieval films to learn the history of the Middle Ages. But when they do go, the chances are that what they watch unfold before them will fire their imaginations and stay with them for the rest of their lives. I have clear memories of watching the Battle of Agincourt from Henry V as a 10-year-old. It is unclear whether the age of the cinema is over, but the age of the moving image is certainly not. That is how most people will continue to get their picture of the past.
Today's long read was written by Robert Bartlett, a medievalist who has presented a number of BBC series on the Middle Ages. His most recent book, The Middle Ages in the Movies, was published by Reaction Books in 2022. Thanks again to the Royal National Institute of Blind People for their help voicing this article, which first appeared in the March 2024 issue of BBC History magazine.